Good afternoon. Welcome to In Context with Ken and Gus, WPKN's public affairs call-in program. This is the Monday, September 17th, 2012 edition. My name is Gus Candavero, and Ken McDermott Rowe is on vacation, will not be with us today. As usual, we're joined by Marchand, our military affairs commentator.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And guest hosting today is DJ Jeep Ward.
Hey, what's up?
Also WPKN host. The websites are incontextreport.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/incontextreport, and on YouTube, youtube.com/incontextreport. And the website for the radio station is WPKN.org, where you can listen to us live stream there, get the podcast after the shows are over, the archives, rather. And today we'll be discussing a broad topic that many people have many strong opinions on, and that is, does capitalism work, and does it exist in America? We'll be opening up the phone lines in a short time. We'll be taking your calls to hear your opinions. Alternatively, you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll relay your comments on the air. Now, last week, the Federal Reserve announced a third round of quantitative easing known as QE3. The Federal Reserve will buy risky mortgage-backed securities at a rate of $40 billion a month for an unlimited amount of time. And there's actually a second part of that program with an additional $40 billion a month, but that will be spent in different ways. In addition to the bailout, economic stimulus checks from George W. Bush, Obama has overseen three rounds of quantitative easing and multiple bailouts of the financial sector and auto industries all in the last 5 years. In a free market capitalist economy, I can't see how this kind of outright economic manipulation and wealth transfer to the upper class can be allowed. What we've seen is that the wealthiest 1% in 1962 of all Americans had 125 times the net worth of the median household. Today, the wealthiest percent of all Americans has 288 times the net worth of the median household. Now, and this is in the past 5 years in a supposedly bad economy, we've seen the wealthy get exponentially wealthier, and that's the middle class and the poor just continue to sink. And I always think of it as if we're all hanging on to one rope, climbing up to the top step. They just cut the rope right below that top 5%, and everybody else just drops to the bottom. You should fend for yourselves. What do you guys make of capitalism and our American economy?
Well, it's funny. I was talking with my parents about this yesterday when I had dinner over there. Fudgy the whale cake.
And, yay.
So we were talking about, can the American economy come back, you know, back to the roaring days of the 50s and early 60s when, you know.
Car in every garage
and a dog in every yard and a baby in every belly.
Mm-hmm.
Yummy
belly.
Yes. And basically it's, you know, manufacturing has gone away from America. Just look at Bridgeport, how many, mm-hmm, you know, empty warehouses there are.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it is that companies need to stop looking at short-term profit margins and look at long-term engendering a good economy in the country in which they live, mm-hmm, or work out of, which is America.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to create jobs for, you know, what made the economy strong and what made the U.S. strong is that people who, you know, had a high school diploma or didn't have a high school diploma or didn't have the education because they couldn't afford to go to college or whatever, they were still able to go out and get a job where they could make a decent wage and a decent living, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you worked on the floor at a factory, you could raise a family. You could, if you were the man, you could have your wife stay at home and take care of the kids if you wanted.
Well, what did Henry Ford say?
Yeah,
with his factories, he wanted his employees to be able to buy the vehicles that they produced, right?
Exactly. And I think that a lot of companies have gone away from that and are just interested in humongous profit margins and just churning. You know, you have like a revolving door of CEOs where, you know, just look at JCPenney. They brought in somebody from Apple. What does this dude know anything about selling what JCPenney sells?
Well,
nothing.
And I think, you know, I think you really hit it on the head. I mean, one of the things that there's a historical context here. I mean, looking at especially when you look at Rome right before the fall of the Republic, one of the problems you had was the the fact that the Roman landlords who made up the senators didn't really, they were there to represent the people, but they really didn't represent the people. They were the 1%. They owned all the land, and they would employ slaves instead of employing working honest free men, because the slaves were cheaper, because slaves, obviously they're slaves. They work for free.
Yeah.
But so as a result, you had massive unemployment in Rome, and that led to a lot of popular unrest, which ultimately was what led to the rise of Caesar. But there's a historical pattern here where the elites, whether the nobility in many systems or whether the corporate elites decide, well, you know what, we're going to first of all narrow the funnel to success, so that this way, in order to become successful, before you could have a high school diploma, become a police chief, well, now you have to have a master's degree in criminal justice just to be a beat cop. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to get your PhD to just work, be a teller at a bank. So they narrow that funnel to success so that there's less competition for them at the top. Then they, you know, whether it's employing illegal immigrants, whether it's employing getting products made in China or India for like 2 cents an hour, it constricts, I think is the word I'm looking for, the middle class.
Yeah. Well, basically what it is widening the gap between the upper class and the middle class, you know. So essentially, if you're making $75,000 and below, you're like assed out.
Exactly.
In all forms, you know,
especially
tax-wise,
where you live in the country plays a big part of that. And when we have this national conversation like last year, with the Occupy Wall Street movement, it was talking about that six-figure number. You know, if you make over whatever $125,000 and the tax rate and so forth. But if you live in New York City and you make $125,000, I don't think that's middle class.
No,
live in Fairfield County and you make $125,000, I still don't think that's middle class, because you're not able to actually save for a future, own your house free and clear, have a child or two, and potentially save for college.
Well, and that's where. Excuse me. You see that spreading of that widening gap. You know, $100,000 in Toledo, where I used to live, would be, I mean, you live like a king.
Big bucks.
You know? But I was lucky to make $7 an hour. But but that would be big bucks in Toledo. But New York or the Greenwich Fairfield County area, it'd be nothing. But I think that's why the corporate elites do this. Why they want to see this distancing of they want to see this massive wage difference.
But part of what I don't understand about it is, okay, if these people want to stay at the top, they're talking about trickle-down economics. So, like, you know, the people that get at the top get all the money, and we are paying these people because their decision-making abilities are obviously worth 250 times your average Joe who's working for this company,
right,
which is absurd. Well, nobody's decision-making is worth that. Well, if you look at the U.S., CEOs, what they're paid versus the average salary of a regular Joe employee versus anywhere else in the world, the highest it tops out in Europe is 30 times, whereas in the US it's 200 and some odd times more, which is it makes no sense. Why is that person's decision making ability worth all that much? And most times these people that they bring in who are consultants or new CEO is going to turn this company around, they drive it more into the ground, and they just bail out. They're like, I'm out. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
Sorry, everybody else who's been working here for 50 years. I stole your pension and I'm out.
Right. Yeah, Enron. Exactly, right?
Yeah.
I think that I wanted to go back to one of my opening comments was about the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Now, I think that central planning, where you have insiders making the rules and essentially bailing themselves out because they know that they have these golden parachute clauses. But if the company fails, they get nothing. So if Goldman Sachs is able to pull in a profit, even though they made bad bets by bailing out AIG, which then sends the money upstream to Goldman Sachs, who is covering their bad bets, now all of a sudden Goldman Sachs is profitable again, even though they're on the brink of failure. And that money comes from the Fed, which is taxpayer funded. And we are on the hook for that borrowed money because of the Fed. Remember, the Fed cannot create money out of thin air. It's loaned into existence and has to be paid back. So all that bailout money that diverted to Goldman Sachs, to Chase Manhattan Bank, and to the other CEOs that run these corporations, that
money has to be paid back.
That has to be borrowed, as Jeep said, on credit from other countries who loan it to us, who then loan it into existence to our own government. Which it's a big Ponzi scheme. It's a shell game, like you're out on the street and some shady character calls you over and says, here, you know, find the coin under the cup, and he's going back and forth with the cups, and you pick the wrong one. Oh, sorry, now you owe $150 billion. You know, it's a really big debt that you have to pay back. And this is our future that we are banking on. Now, I want to...
One distinction that I would like to say is the Fed is not, it's not a government organization.
Right, it's a non-government.
It's a non-government organization. It's a bunch of private banks that get together and talk about interest rates, and it has nothing to do at all with the government. I mean, yes, the it has to do with the economy, and they help with the government, but it's all private institutions that are creating this organization. So
like,
they're all for-profit institutions. Which, they're not doing things in the interest of, they're playing with your money but making decisions based on what's best for them.
It's a privately held institution, and the board of directors of the Federal Reserve is representatives from the Bank of England, say. The Bank of New York.
It's in the spirit of the Bank of England.
It's funny because they actually have stake in it. You know, they have shares in the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve, for those who don't understand it, it's a series of smaller branches in the United States that are supposed to oversee the local regions, and then they get together and they vote on the policies, and then you have the chairman, Ben Bernanke, who makes the final call. And with this last round of quantitative easing, 11 out of the 12 members voted in favor of it, surprise, because they all get to benefit from it. I wonder who that one person who voted against it was. But it is a continuity of agenda from administration to administration, Republican to Democrat back to Republican. It doesn't really matter. We have the same series of inflation that is going to take place one administration after another, benefiting that top 0.1%, really, and then their henchmen making up the rest of the 1%. And I think people misdirect their anger at anybody driving a Mercedes or a BMW who owns a pizzeria or something like that. And then say, you know, good for them, fine. They like German engineering.
Most likely they're probably leasing it, too.
Exactly. You know? So don't break their windows. They're in debt.
Yeah.
But the point is, I was looking at some of the research out there, and I found a quote from Charles Scaliger at the New American. This is from September 16th. And he said, "The Fed is caught in a snare of its own devising, unable to resist micromanaging the money supply, unable to exert any influence, save for the worse. If interest rates are kept at essentially zero, stagflation will continue apace. If they are raised, already hard-pressed debtors, including perhaps the government itself, may be forced to abandon any lingering semblance of fiscal responsibility." So he's drawing the comparison, saying that the government is in the same situation that, say, subprime borrowers were in a couple of years ago. Now they're forced to continue borrowing money in order to keep the gravy train going and keep the country from collapsing. But what do you think? Is a controlled collapse the best thing for us so that we can actually escape this debt like a strategic default?
I think probably what it is, what would be best is to be demanding that businesses, you know, have a certain percentage, say 60 to 70% of their businesses be done in U.S. and create U.S. labor wages.
Well, that's a protectionist policy, though.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. I definitely.
I mean, if I were a Republican, I'm not anything. Actually, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican.
I'm playing devil's advocate here.
And I can totally dig it. But if I were a Republican, I'd just say, well, let it all collapse. You know, let's let the market sort it out. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's never been an instance of an unfettered free market, and the market will always correct itself.
Of course, I will. And I find the whole principle of, you know, you look at capitalism is great and wonderful in principle, like any system is great and wonderful in principle. I mean, communism, great and wonderful in principle. But one of the problems...
If you live on a farm.
Exactly. If you live on a farm that, you know, you're not really
or
too concerned.
Or the farm in Tennessee.
I was going to say. But, exactly. But, that having been said, the problem that we have is that this is out of control. What I like to classify as sort of ultra-capitalism. Kind of like you have Maoism, which is the extreme form of communism. Mm. What we have is an extreme form of capitalism. It's run for the profit of the bankers. It's not run with the national interest. And it's not run for the, you know, all this talk of the trickle-down effect and everything.
It never worked.
What the Federal Reserve's concerned with is ensuring its profitability. What the corporate leadership in America is concerned with is preserving their ability to make profit. And if we suffer for that, all the, you know, what skin is it off their nose? And one of the things I think is brilliant is you want to keep the nation at the behest of the bankers, at the behest of the industry. what better way to do it than keeping the nation in debt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because then you're beholden to all these interests who are like, well, you know, I'd love to help you out, but you got to pass some laws for me, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Let's look at example of, say, the Dodd-Frank reform that was supposed to...
800 some odd pages.
It's supposed to correct all the problems that we have. Instead, what it does is it stifles competition. We have a government that exists to perpetuate the power structure, shall we say, so that they say, we want to get rid of small banks that compete with the larger banks. So we're going to put all of these regulations in place so that they have to hire more staff and they have to harass their customers, and they have to lower the interest rates that they can return back for their customers because they're going to have to cover the expenses of hiring all these extra helping hands to cover all these questionnaires that they have to fill out. But the big banks, they already hire thousands and thousands of people, have hordes of accountants that can go over this stuff. So whenever they have to analyze very closely a single $10,000 transaction, because that's what they require that you do now, they have to increase their fines and fees at the small banks. So they're trying to cut them out of the pie like a mafia, you know, because they're not paying their protection money.
Well, they want to keep the sort of the, you know, oligarchy. I don't know what, because it's not necessarily a monopoly. It's like four or five players, but... You know, it's a monopoly in a sense of like those
collusion.
Four or five people. Yeah. And part of what it is that they're trying to keep this power structure in place, because that power structure keeps funding these political people's campaigns so that they can get reelected and so that they can pass the laws that are advantageous to these companies. Whereas, like, the trail of the money always leads to why decisions are being made, which is unfortunate. You know, I always talk about how Congress terms being only 2 years, you can't get anything done. From the moment that person is in office, all they are concerned about is fundraising for the next election cycle.
I agree with that. I actually think that Congress should be extended to 4 years and Senate should be retracted to 4 years. I think Senate's too long. It's six.
Yeah.
You know, that's not enough time, or that's too much time to run around uncontrolled.
Yeah.
Now, if you're listening, if you just tuned in, you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM. The stream is WPKN.org. We listen to the program live. The show you're listening to is In Context with Ken and Gus, and my name is Gus Candivero. My co-host Ken McDermott-Rowe is on vacation this week, and joining me is Marchand, our military affairs commentator, and guest hosting today is DJ Jeep. He's the regular host on WPKN, and today we're talking about, does capitalism work, and does capitalism exist in America? A little later on in the program, we're going to give it over to Marchand to talk about the controversial film The Innocence of Muslims and the attacks it's provoked on the American embassy in Libya and elsewhere. If you want to give us a call, please feel free to do so at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And if you want to give us an email, you can at ken@mdrtalk.org.
One thing I'd like to mention about our capitalist system that we have in place now is it's unmanageable, because it runs on the theory or the idea that there are unlimited resources, that resources can never run out. That you know, like the oil industry.
Okay.
There's a finite amount of oil on this planet, and at some point it's going to be gone.
Well, I mean, but will technology find an alternative source or another way to use it?
Well, I mean, they're hoping like hell that it's going to, you know, but. Yeah. I mean, there are limited resources. You know, I've heard about things in the fishing industry and the farming industries where, you know, climate change and just, you know, general, you have to come up with this amount of catch to be able to, like, not have your boat repossessed or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you have to keep catching that.
We
you
are
can't
overfishing.
Do it. All the time.
Right.
You can't keep growing the same amount of crop all the time, especially if it's the same crop every single season.
But I think that's why they like, you know, the high unemployment rates and whatnot, because then now you have an abundance of the ultimate resource, people. because when you have high unemployment, people will work for next to nothing.
So what, are we going to go to Soylent Green now?
Well, you know, it's...
Well, that has been a long-standing advocacy on this show. We've been trying to get people to go for Soylent Green for a long time.
I think we should start farming cockroaches and basically grind them up and turn them into, like, tempeh patties. You know, that's, like, super high protein right there. you know, like, just let the cows and the buffalo be. Let's eat cockroaches and
cockroach
caterpillars.
Burgers.
You know, yeah. As long as you don't tell them it's from roaches, you just say... protein.
Well, we could just start a national campaign and just make it cool.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I hadn't had breakfast Justin Bieber this morning, and now I really am not hungry anymore. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's not like there's going to be legs or anything hanging out.
No, it'd be ground up.
Yeah, the principle.
Be nice and ground up.
Then we could have like Justin Bieber.
You can have firm, soft. Like, Justin Bieber will be talking about how awesome it is to be eating these
Rihanna
protein
can tweet about
patties.
It.
Yeah. You know, you can hydrate naturally and get protein naturally with Rihanna.
You're killing me.
Cockroach patties.
Well, you know what?
All the cool kids eat them.
I'm sure 300 years ago, they never would have believed that we'd be eating, you know, neon orange cheese puffs. So,
no, of course not.
You know,
so they 300 years ago, they wouldn't even believe that we'd be eating lobster. You know, I mean, the Puritans wouldn't eat crustaceans because they were like, they're just big insects. They're not fit for Christians.
Well, they're bottom feeders.
Yeah. And they do. Yeah. I mean, they eat all the crap that you see at the bottom, but they are quite tasty.
Especially with a little butter and lemon.
I stopped eating cephalopods. I can't eat an animal that does art. They do art on the seafloor. When they devour an animal, they devour an animal, and then they take its bones and make art.
Oh, they place it around?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
There's more that can be said for cows. What have they done that's so great?
Yeah. Yeah. Get it together, Hindus. Start making some burgers. Anyway, I think we're getting a little off track here.
Not a surprise.
Yeah, right. This economy runs on the idea that there's unlimited resources and that, you know, none of these things can be exhausted. And, well, if they exhaust one source, well, you go to somebody else. And I've had it happen to me in a smaller sense with engineering. Mm-hmm. When I used to work for commercial radio and engineer, I used to hate it when salesperson would come up to me and be like, I got this great idea for, you know, this, that, and the other. We're going to work it out with this business. It's going to be amazing. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds amazing, only it is physically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, you can't physically make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, well, maybe we'll have to find somebody who can. And I'm like,
you're just
okay,
not trying hard enough.
If you could bend the rules of physics, I would love to meet the person who could do that because obviously they can disappear and cloak themselves as well. So I would love to know who this person
well,
is.
Well, see, you're kind
and
of.
And I feel like the economy is that same way. You know, you look at Walmart, their managers have to cut costs 20% every single year. Every single year.
Impossible.
And it's like, well, how am I going to cut costs? Like, okay, you take away healthcare from your employees, you cut wages, you cut people to halftime so you don't have to like pay them as much. You don't have to worry about them.
Well, you can give
them
more work without giving them a pay raise.
Exactly,
and get
you
more
cut
productivity.
Them to 29.5 hours rather than 30 hours.
And that gets into the whole issue of, you know, if employees, capitalism only works when people have enough surplus income after their bills, after their expenses,
exactly,
to go out and spend money. But when you're making $7 an hour, you can't afford to shop at the Walmart you work
well,
at.
Well, hold on, though. But we're getting a little too ahead of ourselves because this country was built on a capitalist economy. Let's look at the living standards that we have had and the economy that we had all the way through, say, the 1960s when it started to tank a little bit. But now we have a disposable economy where every product we buy is only meant to exist for a short amount of time, right?
Yeah,
so you buy a refrigerator,
cars.
And they used to live the last 50 years. They were like cast iron and it's ridiculous. Like they broke, you just replaced the fan or something. Very few moving parts with a heavy door and so forth, so they kept the cold in. Now, what does a refrigerator last? You're lucky if it lasts 10 years, right? And they're thin, they're lightweight, so the power goes out, they lose their cold in 4 hours, and your food starts to go bad. Or computers. I mean, computers last a very short amount of time, and that's understandable because, you know, you have so many parts in there that get constantly upgraded, but I have a feeling that there is an answer to that problem with removable parts that can be more cheaply replaced instead of having it be so complicated to upgrade your computer. I'm sure with Ingenuity we could fix this problem so that we don't have to throw out the whole computer and replace just, I don't know, maybe that's yet to come, but people were paid a living wage to be an engineer, to be an electrical engineer, to produce these kinds of things like cars and so forth that were done really well. Cars made in the 50s are still on the road, or can be if you take care of them.
Yeah.
But a Honda that you bought in the 80s is probably rotted through.
Yeah.
Well, that's just it.
I find that as well with, just turntables.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the industry standard, just we have a pair here, is Technics 1200s. Those are amazingly well designed, and mm-hmm. the design has not changed at all, really, except for like a couple mods or things that you can put on it.
But are the parts cheaper?
They don't make them anymore.
Oh, okay.
Technics stopped making them because I think they wanted to go into high end stereo. But that's neither here nor there. What the thing is, it is a completely mechanical device.
Mm-hmm.
Something that if you have a problem with it, and you know anything about engineering or whatever, you can just pop it open and be like, oh, there's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas almost every other turntable on the market is not completely mechanical.
You may as well throw it away.
If you have a startup problem or if you have like tracking problems with the turntable, you might as well get rid of it or sell it to somebody who you don't like.
But that's where we get,
right.
Well, yeah, but that's where we get to, you know, kind of one of the roots of the problem is that if you're in a capitalist system that works, you pay your employees a livable wage and you want to create the best possible product. Because if you create the best possible product, you know, the longest lasting, the most durable, then more people are going to buy it. But when you have an oligarchy or a monopoly market, you make a cheap product, you don't pay your employees enough. And in order for capitalism to work, you have to have the people with the disposable income and you have to have the competition. You know, the desire to create the best product.
You have to have a living wage, right?
It's almost as if the 1% is depending on themselves to be able to keep the economy going
ironically,
as consumers.
They are.
Because hardly anybody has the money to be able to, you know, buy the products that they're helping to create or whatever. And that's why I think is funny is that, you know, with the gap widening between middle class and you have, you know, a husband and a wife both working, hardly able to spend time with their kids, working, you know, at least a job, if not two jobs apiece, to be able to, like, pay their bum mortgage and to be able to take care of their kids and maybe save a little bit for mm-hmm, college mm-hmm. for them. Where do they have the disposable income to be able to spend on something? And that's where credit comes in.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation,
and it gives people the idea that they have disposable income when it's just another bad debt that they're taking on.
Mm-hmm. If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN. If you'd like to give us a call, join the conversation, you can at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756, or you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Now, you mentioned that it seems like the top is sort of trying to perpetuate themselves by putting themselves in this circle, like a hamster wheel, like they don't need anybody else, right?
Yeah.
And they just sort of have these slaves thrown at them that they munch on to give them energy, and they run the hamster wheel and keep going and keep going. That's basically the stock market. They require the stock market to keep going, and people who own stocks have, I think, 83%, the top wealthy people own 56% of stocks. And they've gotten more and more wealthy, but the suckers who are trying to get into that casino and play that game are buying stocks, but they're losing because they don't have the inside track to know what's going to succeed and what isn't. So if you're out there and you think that the road to success is to own some stocks, well, you're probably going to have your hat handed to you because you don't have the inside information that they do. Like Goldman Sachs has the trading computer that gets the information milliseconds before it makes it onto the CNBC ticker, and their computer algorithms are programmed to make the trades to make a profit. So they never lose. They can't lose. It's impossible.
Which could you then compare our kind of controlled economy, albeit corporate controlled, mm-hmm. to that of like, you know, China or the Soviet Union, where
well, that's why I
controlled.
Say it's not capitalist.
Yeah.
That I will maintain that we do not have a capitalist system, that we have the illusion of capitalism so that you can go and start a shop. And
we have a new dark ages.
Well, that's I think what I think the new world order is really the old world
yeah,
order.
It's
fiefdoms.
It's medieval times.
medieval times.
Honestly, without the booze and the you know,
and we have
the
forks.
Big things of meat and the dogs. But seriously, I feel like part of what is happening is you do have this sort of like fiefdom kingdom sort of mentality happening, is where you have people who are protecting what they have, whether it be large or small, at any cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, I will stay in this position no matter what. And part of it is also, I mean, look at the job market. You know, you have people staying in jobs well past when they should be in them,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just because of age, but because, you know, they've phoned it in. You know, they don't give a damn about the job, but they're staying there because, you know, because they need a job and they need the wage.
Yeah,
and they,
sure.
you know, worked so long, they have, you know, seniority, even though all their decisions might be considered bad.
Well,
I mean, my wife is in teaching, and she tells me stories all the time about people who have lost the heart for teaching.
Yeah, but they continue to go to work.
They can't leave. They just have to, because the pay is too good compared to what they're going to find in the free market economy. And they have children, and one income in their family is not enough to pay the mortgage and save for college and all these things.
And one of the things I wonder is what we're going to see in terms of, you know, the younger generation, the kids who are just coming out of college now. I look at a lot of my friends, you know, $100,000 in college debt. They can't get off the ground. Yeah, most of them move back in with their parents because they can't get off the ground. A couple have gone on to get master's degrees or are starting to get their master's degrees.
You just go to school forever and defer. Yeah.
And you're perpetually going to end up – but one of the things I find interesting is that a lot of these federal loans, you can't escape the debt by going bankrupt.
No.
So this means that you move in with your parents. You save and save and save.
Right.
And no matter what, you're horribly in debt. You go bankrupt and the debt still follows you. You know, this is kind of like the czars, you know, of Russia, you know, with the serfs. You know, the serfs can never afford to buy their own land.
Right.
You know, it's like the same thing. So now, instead of having where there was a middle class, you have this massive modern serfdom.
Well, the next step is debtor prisons, right, which we were supposed to have done away with hundreds of years ago. But it seems like it's going to make a return. I mean, there was an article last year of the Department of Education kicked in the door of this single father. His wife had left Skip Town, and she had massive amounts of student loan debt. And they kicked in the door with a battering ram and guns, and they demanded to know where she was. She wasn't there. They went through there and ransacked the house looking for information and money and so forth, like a literal hit, right?
Yeah.
And she wasn't even there anymore. And he said, poor guy, he doesn't know his rights. All he wanted was for them to fix his door.
Yeah.
You know, but they had him out in the front yard in his underwear, frisking, you know, like, where are you hiding the gold? You know,
and of course, all his neighbors are like, man, what's this dude like? Yeah. Selling drugs.
Yeah,
that's like the neighborhood.
Right?
That's like Russia. I mean, that sounds just like Russia.
The Department of Education with guns and battering rams.
The Department of Education, the IRS, or the Social Security Service. I was reading on InfoWars has they're equipping these guys.
357s.
357s. I mean, just
Department
give you
some, of Education.
No, the, Social Security.
Social Security.
Social Security.
So, you know, in case pensioners decide to revolt, you know, we got 357. Just to give you some
turn
comparison.
Over the Dunbar truck and light it on fire.
Yeah, you know, all these old grannies, you know, but you know, and to give you some comparison, firing a 357 is like firing a small cannon. I mean, you talk about overkill, you know, for the Social Security. I thought we had local police and things like that. You know, why did the Social Security Administration or the Department of Education, why do they need guns? Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, at least tasers. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, this is getting to such a level of absurdity. I mean, it's almost comical. You wouldn't believe it if you went to somebody, you know, in the 1950s and you said
I just can't imagine.
Sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine the Social Security crowd actually rioting, though. I mean,
no.
There was an old doctor. Remember Dr. Katz?
Would riot if Matlock got taken off.
Exactly, you know. Harrison Keeler.
Do you remember the show Dr. Katz?
Yes.
Yeah, there was
Squiggle Vision.
There was a clip that they always played with the chain lock in the city.
Yeah.
You know, like the chain says, you're not getting in here unless you push with your hand. You know, it's like, so I don't think we need guns and tasers and batons to stop the old people. Maybe we can just reason with them and speak and put your hands up and just speak quietly.
Exactly.
Exactly.
You know,
we got a problem, Granny.
And that's why, you know, you hit there is this level. I mean, and I think it shows to the kind of economy we're heading towards, you know, the move away from capitalism, more move towards a controlled authoritarian economy as well as society. I mean, the fact that the Social Security Administration now has 357s. The Department of Homeland Security has 1.4 billion rounds of ammunition. That's more than our military.
40 caliber hollow point.
40 caliber hollow point.
I'll be in the mountains while the gas chamber's deep.
It's enough to shoot every American citizen four times.
It is absurd. But the reason I think all of this is going forward is because we have the illusion of capitalism, but we're moving towards a Soviet-styled economy. Everything's controlled. The government controls every aspect of your existence.
What I'm also concerned about is that the neocons all of a sudden want to bring back the Ruskies as our, like, sworn enemy. And it's like, didn't we get over that?
What's the best way to get the economy going?
Didn't their whole country collapse and we figured out that they were nothing more than a sham of a third world country? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden now we're very concerned that they're, like, amassing power and going to do this and that? Like,
A lot of this is true as long as we want to play that arms race game. But yeah, do we need to? That's the point.
Well, no, we don't need to do it. It's a waste of time, and it is a waste of resources. The way that I look at it is like, invest in something that's going to have some type of return. So don't spend $1 billion on something that's meant to explode.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like we're actually in agreement. There really is no capitalist system here, and what system we do have is just not working, right? I think we all agree on this. So,
I agree. We have a free market economy. But I don't know that we have something called capitalism where I think what we have is a very specialized form of feudalism where you have shop owners or people who are CEOs. Your 1% are your lords. And then you have their underlings who are your nobles. And then you have your gentry, whatever, and then basically middle class down is your country folk who
your serfs.
If it were 500 years ago, they'd be wouldn't have showered in 3 weeks and wear their clothes until they're crusty, and they just cut them off.
Mm-hmm.
it's that type of a feudalist economy that we're working in. But because people have jobs and have the freedom to be able to choose things that they want and have a choice that they can go down to the supermarket and buy some really crappy GMO tomatoes at any time of year, mm-hmm. or kiwis in February or blueberries in March, then we have freedom to be able to do these things. So it makes us feel like, well, it could be worse, and it could be worse. Like, talk to somebody in Rwanda; mm-hmm. it could be a lot worse.
Right.
But because we are at this point, it is our duty as citizens and to overcome that type of thinking and to be able to make this place a better world so that others can say, hey, man, they really did it right. Maybe we should try and do it. As opposed to F everybody, I'm going to make this money, and screw you. I don't even give a damn if you're my kid. Screw you, too.
See, I think the main – where we're going with this system, the overarching point here, you mentioned wars and so forth and this class system that we're edging back into – it seems like there are factions who say the best way to get the economy going is to start another world war.
Even though the last
to thin
three
the herd.
Wars, yeah. The last three wars didn't do a damn thing for our economy, sapped the economy, and brought us into recession.
Well, the top made loads of cash. If we go into another war, Halliburton is going to make a fortune.
Yeah, anybody who's on the government contract dole is going
to
make a.
So if we go back to our main point, which is the economy is driven by private factions who pay the campaign funds for the main candidates, the senators, congressmen, and presidency especially, we need to look at where they get their money from. And if you think that electing Mitt Romney to take the place of Barack Obama is going to amount to any change in policy, I have a bridge to sell you, because nothing is going to change. The only thing that will happen is that we'll get a three-month break from tyranny while Barack Obama collects his things and Mitt Romney sets up his transitional office. That's the only change. I do think that it's better to vote out the incumbent to always have that threat of re-election over their head to maybe at least get them to start to think that this is unpopular. But it's going to end up with war and a centrally planned economy going forward. So the onus is on you, the listener out there, and the population, to do the research to know what the bills are, what they actually say, because we've had an increasing number of people call Congress and show up to the town halls to protest. And I think that it is making a difference. I do think that there has been more people voting against these proposed legislations like the Dodd-Frank reform bill, which do not help the economy at all. But
it doesn't do anything for anybody except for lined pockets.
The problem was created by the corporations, and then the problem is fixed by the corporations. And if you think that it's actually being fixed, then that's a joke.
Well, it's kind of like if I break into your house and steal all your things, I say, but don't worry, I'll fix your front door, you know?
Yeah, or I can sell them back to you on eBay. You just go bid on them.
Exactly.
Hey, dude, I think I saw some of the stuff that got stolen from your house on eBay.
Exactly.
I can send you the link.
You know, so why don't we move into the next topic? We're going to spend 10 minutes talking about this controversial film that's been going around the internet called The Innocence of Muslims. Marchand, you want to take over from here?
Oh, absolutely.
Give us the backstory first.
Well, the film supposedly has been in the works for a little while, cost $5 million. It was supposedly a man by the name of Sam Bessel was behind it, an Israeli-American living in California. And he was going to...
Should I have between my thighs?
Right. There's a piece of the film. I just called it up on YouTube. That I didn't know it started out like that.
No, that was perfect.
It's actually, and that's actually one of the things. The film was designed to be as, in principle, as overtly offensive to Islam as possible. They depict the Prophet Muhammad as a womanizer, a pedophile, a fraud, a shyster, you know, and as a warmonger who advocates killing. Now,
sounds like most people in our government.
Exactly. Oh. Anybody who knows,
that's not too bad, actually. What? You could win an election here.
Yeah, right?
It's, you know,
Muhammad 2012.
It's probably far more apt to describing, you know, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney than it is to describing, you know, or the Bushes than it is to describing the Prophet of Islam. Yeah. Because, you know, anybody who studied anything about Islam knows, you know, that the film is a complete fraud. But what struck me as odd, because, you know, I painfully sat through a couple seconds of it, or a couple minutes of it.
We watched a little bit of it today, and it's shot on a green screen. Anybody with a brain in their head wouldn't watch this for more than 2 seconds, because they know that it's just ridiculous. It looks like a high school project.
It's so badly done.
And I wouldn't have watched it long enough to get to the controversial part.
Exactly. They're dressed in, like, you know, bathrobes with towels on, like towels from, like, the
fake
Hyatt on their head.
Beards.
And fake beards. I mean, it looks utterly ridiculous. So there's this film that's designed to be offensive, that's so badly done it's unbelievable. But then this film costs $5 million, right? So that's a little suspicious. Then all of a sudden it comes out that, you know, they say this Sam Bessel is Israeli did it.
And which is an alias.
Well, the Israeli government says there is no Sam Bessel. We had nothing to do with this. Don't blame us for this. And then it turns out it is this Nakula Baseli Nakula, kind of like Sirhan there. Mm-hmm. And he's this Egyptian Coptic who supposedly made the film, and, you know, but
he's taking credit for it.
He's taking credit for it anyway. But it's ludicrous. And the timing, this is what I find odd. Now, the film comes out, right? First of all, it comes out on the heels of Obama snubbing Netanyahu, right? Mm-hmm. The film comes out, and then there's this attack on the U.S. embassy, or U.S. consulate, I should say, in Libya. Now, this attack is a spontaneous assault. The American media keeps attesting. However, the day after the assault, I was reading the Israeli press, Debka, which is an Israeli intelligence newsletter, debka.com, and Haaretz, the main Israeli newspaper, kind of like their New York Times. And both of them said it was a well-coordinated attack. The protest was just a cover. It was a well-coordinated attack. 10 operatives attacked the front gate. As soon as the attack occurs, the ambassador goes to flee in his vehicle. 10 more Al-Qaeda, quote-unquote,
three bodyguards, right?
With three bodyguards, which is suspicious to begin with, because the ambassador never travels that much alone anywhere in the world, except for some reason in war zone Libya. He's traveling alone, basically.
He feels a little safer.
And, you know,
it's Benghazi. That's the rebel stronghold.
Exactly.
Those are friends.
Why worry? And so they make the run for the vehicle. 10 more operatives come over the wall, push these guys against the wall, basically, and shoot the ambassador and his three bodyguards. Now, what seems ludicrous to me is they say it was spontaneous. Look, you know, as I'm just a military affairs commentator, what do I know? But to launch a planned, coordinated assault like this takes months of rock drills, sand table drills, and battle drills, you know, rehearsing, studying the plans. They had to know our SOPs. They had to know that the ambassador wouldn't go into a safe room, that he would try to flee in his vehicle. They had to know where the vehicles were parked, and they had to have a lot of inside information. It wasn't spontaneous. So it seems to coordinate with the movie. And then as soon as the assault begins, there are these riots all over the world, attacks on other embassies, and suddenly this grand indictment of the Obama quote-unquote plan, you know, the negotiation. We can't talk to these people. Clearly, we can't reason with these radical Muslims.
Yeah.
And so it all seems to pull together. It all seems to come together.
Well, it also proves the point of the film, too. The point of the film is to say that Muslims are inherently violent.
Those heathen
exactly.
Muslims.
And then they go and they prove the point, basically.
Exactly.
You're violent. No, I'm not.
Exactly. It goes to prove.
We know nothing but love.
With my fist. Love
exactly.
My fist.
Which also, I love to, you know, build on that absurdity when people say, you know, Islam is a religion of violence. I'm like, look, a third of the world's population is Muslim. You know, 1.3, 1.4 billion Muslims.
Yeah, and it's not like the world's on fire.
If the world was on fire, there would be logic to that. But, you know, it's kind of like, I like to go to the comparison of, look, every religion, there has been people who claim to do things in the name of God. That's reprehensible. I mean, you know, we have the Crusades. That was pretty reprehensible. But are all Christians to blame for that? No. You know, are all
Christians are to blame for being jerks, though.
Every religion has had people who were jerks at one stage or another. You know,
part of religion is leveraging. Basically leveraging, like, I am more righteous than you.
Well,
and part of what religion gives people is people who have like a esteem or some hole in themselves, whatever it is, it gives them the ability to be like, I'm better than you, well, and you don't matter.
And it gets abused. And one of the things that, you know, of course, a lot of the American people aren't allowed to see that, you know, that religion gets abused by a minority. So, you know, you get Fox News and whatnot coming out saying, well, this goes to prove the film is a part of freedom of speech. And, you know, it proves that Muslims have proved that they're violent because they're ticked off about this ridiculously cheaply made film. But at the same time, and this is what I find brilliant, it's all a cover, because what it's covering up is the escalation of the war. I mean, Jeep actually said earlier, and I think this might have been a good comparison, this might be our assassination of Franz Ferdinand moment, because there's an escalation in the global war occurring, and the American people aren't aware of it because all that's being talked about are Muslims are violent and the movie. But we're deploying more troops worldwide. The violence in the Middle East is escalating. Israel is now saying, we're going to attack Iran in October, and China's made a move on a series of Japanese islands, the Senkoku Islands, as the Japanese call them, or the Doyu Islands, and they've moved a fleet in and seized several of the islands. So this whole global situation is now, this is the catalyst that's escalating it.
My take on all this, and full disclosure, I am a Christian, but I don't disclose that on the air because I don't think that it's relevant to the conversation. I try to keep everything as equal as possible so that I never give myself a superior viewpoint of anybody else to try to call them stupid or whatever. But I definitely think that religion is a power structure that's manipulated throughout the world to get people to infight, because inherently humans don't have any significant difference to each other that would make them fight, except for the power to control territory, right? Mm-hmm. So Muslims are incited to fight each other, right? So we get Libya into this point of catastrophe, and we hand it over from the secular, or at least we get the Libyan fighting group to fight against the secular government, which was protecting Christians and Black Africans and Jews and so forth, and the same thing in Syria. And then when it comes to the point of overthrow, we cut out the Libyan fighting group so that they don't actually have a part in negotiating the new government. Now you have a religious war brewing. So you've got in Iraq, Shia and Sunni, and Iran, Sunni against Shia. And we just keep turning them over so that they fight against each other. And here in America, you get, you know, Reverend Falwell or other people like that to get up on their soapbox and start talking about how God has ordained this war and that Islam is heathen and we need to, you know, basically smush them out. And so you get Santorum and George W. Bush talking about God is on our side.
Yeah.
We can't lose this war. But as a Christian, I take complete offense to everything that they say, because that's not what Jesus talks about. So to actually
Jesus
take it to
all
that
about
point,
being understanding.
And not to force religion on anybody. You can't make someone be a Christian. So if that's not your choice or if that's not your calling, I can't make you be it. And this is probably one of the last times I'll get religious on the show. I try to keep it out, but I feel like it has a place here. So that's the only reason I'm going to say that.
Yeah. No, well, and I totally I totally agree, and I understand that, you know, it's unfortunate that fanatics are what paint a picture for the general public of any religion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at, you know, David Koresh with, mm-hmm. you know, utilizing Christian dogma to be mm-hmm. able to like, tell people to do whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
you know? All you see is fanatics misusing or misinterpreting some form of religion, that all forms of religion are supposed to teach tolerance, understanding, and love.
Well, it's
and
the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And what's the common
thread?
Every
single religion has its own interpretation of it, and that is the biggest tenet of those religions. But people take it out of – they take other parts out of the religion to be able to use for whatever because they're – you know, because they're not right.
Well, which is why, you know, I...
Well, what's the common thread? It's the lack of education, right?
Exactly.
How does radical Islam spread and then, let's say, radical Christianity spread? It's because people don't question authority, right? They just do what they're supposed to do, what they're told to do.
Exactly. And that's why I think you do see this common thread in terms of extremism in every religion. You know, extreme mm-hmm. Hinduism even. You know, you see in, like, very poor areas like Sri Lanka and things mm-hmm. like that, you know, where people don't question because they're not educated. Many of them can't read.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I find is that you can take
it's like the Catholic Bible being written in Latin so that you had to go to church on Sunday to have them read it to you.
Yeah. Exactly. And what people could do if they wanted to is take, you know, the example that the handful of lunatics like, you know, even the KKK who say that they're Christians, but mm-hmm. obviously don't follow the teachings
clearly.
Of Christianity. But then say, well, see, this is an example of how all Christians are. And if you had that propagated in the media every day, people would start to believe it. Same thing in Islam. The second chapter of the Quran says there's no compulsion in religion.
Mm-hmm.
Plainly, it's the third verse down. No, there's no compulsion in religion. And 90% of Muslims practice that. You have the handful of extremists. But the thing is the propaganda machine. The media keeps pumping in. This is a religion of evil. This is, you know, this is the attitude
story
of all of
and they need to sell ad space.
And it's a great distraction.
Right, exactly. And it creates the enemy, just like the Russians or the Chinese. Yeah. If the Russians aren't in your bag, well, here, I've got some Muslims for you.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, you could be afraid of these guys. They wear turbans and they have bombs.
Totally foreign looking.
And the Nazis did the same.
Oh, yo, check it. I was in White Plains a couple of weeks ago and some guy was asking for change and I could tell that he was kind of drugged out and I didn't give him any. So he started calling me a raghead. He said, go back to your country, you raghead. And you don't belong here and you're turban wearing, blah, blah, blah.
I went over to Turkey like 3 or 4 years ago and I bought a Turkish like a shirt. It's just red with the crescent moon and the star.
Yeah.
And I've worn it on tour and I've been like out in the Midwest and West Coast. And, you know, that shirt for some reason, like I'll be at a gas station or something. People like be looking at me.
Yeah.
Like,
what are you going to
say? Is that a Muslim thing? And I'm like, yeah, it's the Turkish flag. And like, are you a Muslim? I'm like, what if I am?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what does it matter?
It feels good, doesn't
think,
it?
You think I'm going to be like, you know, lighting pipe bombs and blowing this place up?
What
like,
is a gas station?
You know?
But I mean,
yeah,
I'm not even Muslim. I'm not Arabian.
Yeah,
I'm not
exactly.
anything. I'm 3/4 Italian and a little bit of Puerto Rican. And I guess when I grow my beard out, I start to look a little shady. But the point is, why?
All
what does that have
beards
to do with
are shady.
Anything?
I mean, just look at me.
It's identical to what the Nazis did. The Nazis did the same thing. If you look at the propaganda videos from the 1930s, you know, saying they would show a synagogue and they'd say, "Are these Germans? They look different. Their beliefs are strange. Are they Germans?" It's like this. It's the exact same thing. Woman
they just
wears a
constantly
headscarf.
Did the play Shylock.
All right, we got to wrap it up here, guys. Good show. So that's going to do it for In Context with Ken and Gus. As you've been listening, Ken is not with us today. He's on vacation. He'll be back next week. I've been here with my fellow co-hosts, Marchand and Jeep Ward. And we've been talking about capitalism in the first half of the show. In the second half, we talked about the new controversial film, The Innocence of Muslims. If you'd like to hear the podcast, you can go to our website, incontextreport.com. And you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/incontextreport. Find us on YouTube as well, search In Context Report. And we'll be back next week. And that'll do it for this show.
Thanks. You've been listening to WPKN Bridgeport broadcasting at 89.5 FM and, of course, online at WPKN.org.
See you next time.
Bye.